This actually gets us to the moon now. We're going to be on there.
Well, this morning, Owen described the number of plateaus in the Apollo lunar mission, and actually each one of these could be described as a climactic point. If we had to pick one that was really the climax of the whole mission, my vote would go for the lunar landing. This is the first time when we make the lunar landing that the LM is going to be operated in the entire environment for which it's designed. It's the first time also that the man is going to come face to face with all these environmental problems that we have showed concern about. And we're going to simulate this phase of the mission many times. We have already. Before we're ready to go, it's going to be simulated just as extensively as we possibly can. And we plan to be ready for it, but we won't know just how well we've done until we get back. And if we start off by considering theoretically how you could make the lunar landing approach, it might appear as we have on the first slide. This is exaggerated, of course. We're at a 80 nautical mile orbit, and on the back side of the moon, the Earth being in this direction, we perform a separation and a Hohmann transfer type of maneuver using a little over 100 feet per second of fuel, and coast down to on a trajectory that becomes tangent to the surface of the moon 180 degrees later. If we had infinite thrust to weight ratio, we could stop right there at a cost of fuel of 5,622 feet per second. If we added these two numbers together, we get a total cost of 5,731. We're coming in on a flight path angle in the terminal phase of 0 degrees. It's obvious that this is both an impractical and an impossible approach. Impractical because of terrain uncertainties and guidance uncertainties, things of that nature, and impossible because we don't have an impulsive delta V capability. So we must be practical about this, and we've examined the possible combination of terrain uncertainties, guidance uncertainties, and been conservative and picked a perigee altitude to shoot for at this point of 50,000 feet. Now, the choice of 50,000 feet was somewhat arbitrary, as indicated on this chart that shows the variation of characteristic velocity on the bottom scale with initial thrust-to-weight ratio for different choices of paracentian altitude. Now, if we had chosen 40,000 feet or 60,000 feet as opposed to 50,000 feet, you can see it wouldn't have made a big difference in our characteristic velocity. Now, using these values of 50,000 feet and our initial thrust-to-weight ratio of the engine that we're going to use to descend, you can see the trajectory comparison on the next slide, where we go through the same maneuver. This time, the cost is slightly less because we're only going down to 50,000 feet. And in the powered descent, the expenditure now is going up to 5,925 feet per second, which includes about 80 feet per second for a 100-foot vertical descent to the surface. Our terminal flight path, just as we approach the point of vertical descent, is going up to 9 degrees. Now, to compare the two, in the case of the impulsive thrust, the total delta V, 5,731, zero flight path angle, theoretical, or 3/10 thrust to weight, theoretical still, 6,023, or almost 300 feet per second more, coming in on a 9-degree flight path angle. Now, expanding this trajectory to scale, we see the total trajectory covering some 220 nautical miles, and the final portion of this trajectory has been expanded in the lower part of the figure. We've indicated a couple of points along the way, giving the altitude and attitude, velocity, and flight path angle. The main characteristic is that it's a low flat profile. And if you would note the attitude of the limb all the way, in fact, right on down to the surface, you can see that The thrust vector is pointed pretty much in the direction of where you want to land. And without windows in the bottom of the vehicle, we would not be able to see where it is we're going to land. Now, our premise is that we want the crew to be in the loop in this phase, to at least look over the landing area, to assess it, and to pick out the best spot to go. Well, it's obvious that if he's not able to see where he's going, he can't do this job. So we must shape the trajectory somewhat in the final portion to allow him to visually acquire the area and to make this assessment. Now, there's no point in providing him visibility at ranges beyond which he could really see. We're faced with a fuel limitation, just as in all the rest of the phases, so it's obvious that a strategy has to be developed that trades off the desire of getting an assessment of the landing area and keeping compatible with the requirements of fuel. So that's the real purpose of this talk, to go through some of the strategy considerations. Now, the objectives of the strategy development indicated here, it's pretty simple: to anticipate all the lunar environment problems that we are hopefully aware of, and to plan the approach so that the combined spacecraft systems, including the crew, will most effectively improve the probability of attaining a safe landing. The major factors that really contribute here are the orbital mechanics type problems, and we've discussed some of these already, the performance limitations of the spacecraft system, again, including the fuel limitations, the guidance dispersions, things of that type, and again, the lunar environment type of problems, the visibility, the terrain, uncertainties, and irregularities. Now, all of the LEM systems are important. Otherwise, they wouldn't be in there. The ones that seem to predominate in the development of the strategy, however, are the four that are listed here: the guidance and control system, landing radar, descent propulsion, and the LEM window, if you can call it a system. The characteristics of the guidance and control system have been discussed by Cliff Duncan, and it primarily affects the LEM strategy because it determines the initial conditions at the start of the power descent, the accuracy of the navigation, and hence determines the dispersions in the landing area. And this, in turn, turns out to be very important to our strategy in the final portion. To sum up the landing accuracy, we have a chart here that breaks the navigation phase contribution down into three parts. The numbers that really are important turn out to be the CEP here. We have, in addition to the lunar orbit portion of it that has been presented previously, the powered maneuver at separation and initiation of Holmann descent, the uncertainties there contribute to the CEP, and then the actual power descent itself, the inertial system uncertainties and the growth of the dispersions, are all RSS together into the total accuracy. We show a column both for MSFN and onboard. MSFN, of course, is the primary means of our navigation. We will do onboard navigation as a backup, and there is an advantage to this, as we'll discover later on, in eliminating some of the altitude uncertainties. The CEP, in either case, is within the 3,000-foot CEP of the spec. The assumptions for this work are indicated on the next slide. I believe that these assumptions are, in general, the same that were mentioned this morning. These particular numbers were for the case where we land at 0-0 on the moon, and we use two landmarks, three sightings per landmark, for a total of three orbits. So I won't go into these assumptions in more detail at this time. Another way to look at the guidance dispersions or to look at the three sigma error ellipses on the surface. This assumes that through some way we've taken out the altitude uncertainty. In the top figure, we see the three sigma air ellipse, both for navigation done on board the LEM and for the navigation done by MSFM. And they're about the same. The major axis has a dimension here of about 20,000 feet by 10,000 feet cross range. And they're roughly equal. A special case is shown down here, which is where we let the range constraint go free. In other words, we're not guiding to a particular point, but we're guiding to any point that we happen to hit along the range. In this case, the downrange or the major axis would have a dimension of about 52,000 feet. The cross range would be the same as it was in the case where we navigated and used the guidance system trying to get to a point. This slide indicates, as you recall this morning, there were three different types of areas that we would have to consider. One being landing at any suitable point within a specified area. The implication being that the area could be quite large, but any place we hit, we would accept with some minor variation. That might go with this range-free type. The second one is landing at any suitable point within a smaller area, constrained in size primarily by the guidance system. So this could be either one of these cases or the combination of these. And the last one, where we would land to some pre-specified point, which would still be this case, but we would have to allow enough fuel in the budget to make sure that once we got down, we could maneuver over to the exact point that we wanted within that ellipse. The landing radar is actually part of the overall guidance and control system, but it's very important to the strategy because it's the means whereby we eliminate some of the altitude uncertainties. This slide just shows the configuration of the landing radar, the beam configuration, and also points out that it's a two-position antenna, so that in the early portion of the trajectory, where the LEM is tilted back with the thrust being pointed toward the landing site, the beam configuration can still be close to normal to the surface. Now, it's a Doppler system with four beams, the middle beam in the back measuring altitude, and the other three beams being used to measure velocity along each axis. So we see that as we are ready to land and the LEM becomes close to the vertical, that we have a means of getting the antenna beam configuration normal to the surface to improve our accuracy. Now, the accuracy is given on the slide on the right, where we have it as a function of altitude, and then the range to the surface, or for the radar itself, whenever the altimeter beam is perpendicular to the surface, and this is altitude, and then for the other two, velocity parameters along each of the axes. That's a very accurate system, and it appears that it's going to meet its performance. The one that becomes the most important is the accuracy in the low-altitude region. I'd like to point out that this is a three-sigma type of accuracy, and we're talking about an absolute minimum of about 1.5 feet per second for all three axes. You don't normally think of a window as a system, but this is looking inside the LEM, and it shows the physical configuration of the window. It's triangular in shape, and we see the ghost image of the pilot sitting up close to it. This one is also useful because it shows the relationship of the window and the pilot and some aspects of the guidance system. If you recall from this morning that the flight instruments are in here, but the display and keyboard is down here, and it's through this, the display and keyboard, that the pilot receives information that he couples together with information from the window. The markings on the window here are what we call the landing point designated grid. We'll discuss this in a little bit more detail later. Now, the pilot stays very close to the window, and even though the window is is fairly small in size. Because he is close, it provides a very wide field of view, as indicated in this figure where we've plotted the lateral angle that he is able to view and also the elevation angle. Normally, looking dead ahead, he's looking at 0, 0. Now, it's difficult to plot this on one plane. The lateral angle actually goes from dead ahead almost all the way out to one side. And he's able to look down by some 65 degrees. Now, this limitation changes a little bit if he moves his head away from the design eye position. The other system that was mentioned earlier as being very important is the descent engine. Earlier, this engine was to be fully throttleable over a 10-to-1 ratio, but we've had to, because of design considerations, limit the area over which it's throttleable. We show here a plot of thrust against time in seconds, where this might go out to whatever the total limb descent profile would call for. And it's throttleable from about 1,000 pounds up to 6,300. It has a fixed throttle position in the upper region where, because of some erosion of the nozzle, the thrust might grow from a typical value of 9,700 pounds upward slightly over some 300 seconds. There is an uncertainty as to what this thrust would be even on a given engine, starting out with a value of about plus or minus 1.5%, growing to as much as plus or minus 2.5%. Now, earlier on the theoretical slide showing the fuel expenditure as a function of thrust to weight, it's pretty obvious that we'd like to use as high thrust to weight as we can. So we want to use this upper region as much as we possibly can. We've considered the trade-offs that we can identify, and just to jump ahead, I'd like to give you the general answer and then explain it. The design breaks down into a three-phase design. Starting with the powered descent initiation, we go through a phase that we call the braking phase, and winding up at a point that we call high gate. Now, this is a point that's described both by position and velocity. Then a phase called final approach, terminating at low gate, and then the landing phase, of course, terminating with the landing. The whole thing covers some 250 nautical miles, and this is not to the right altitude scale. Now, the logic of the phases is summarized here. The braking phase is one that we're far enough away from the landing area to where we're not worried about the attitude too much, and we can select an attitude that allows efficient reduction of most of the velocity. The final approach phase is where we want to allow the pilot to visually acquire and to make an assessment of the landing site, and also to give him the chance to confirm that at that point, in his judgment, flight safety allows him to continue. The landing phase, of course, allows vernier control of position and velocity. Now, this is shown to scale in the next slide, where again, we've indicated data at various points along the way. It's still a low flat profile. The total range is some 247 nautical miles. We've indicated a couple of other discrete points, maximum throttle here, and we've added a region at low throttle here but to allow the descent engine gimbal trim to take out the moments induced by any CG offsets so that we don't waste RCS fuel. On the right, we again show the blow up of it from 30 nautical miles on in and indicate where high gate would be. And when we've chosen, high gate's only about 5.5 miles back from where we're going to land. So we see the braking phase from engine ignition all the way down to high gate covers some 98% of the total trajectory. We're doing the shaping that we described earlier only in the last 2%. That last 2% of range takes a minimum of 30% of the time. If we do any hover, it's going to add to that percentage. Now, we have a problem in guiding because if you want to guide from one position in velocity to the other, you'd like to have continuous control over both thrust and attitude. But in order to use the fixed position, we have to make some modifications and allow a region prior to high gate that we plan to use the throttle in the lower region so that we can make sure that we adjust the velocity to satisfy the conditions that we described at high gate. Now, just to go back into some of the objectives of the braking phase, and now to take this and to go into some of the detail of all the phases. The objectives, again, of the braking phase are to reduce the velocities using efficient use of the propellant and to reach the state vector that we described. Constraints, the descent engine being not throttleable in the maximum region that we'd like to operate, and the thrust to weight of the order of 3/10, and the fixed thrust uncertainties. Even though the guidance computer has a great capacity, we don't like to use it in an inefficient way. We'd like to use the same set of guidance equations throughout the descent, if at all possible, and that's the way we presently are planning it. In this trajectory, we show again a general profile, altitude against range, and also the thrust level against range, and indicating some of the milestones at high gate and this fictitious target that I described earlier. Now, the idea is that if we have a nominal thrust out of the descent engine where it would follow the solid line, then we would hit the desired position and velocity of our fictitious target, and at that point could enter the throttleable region of the descent engine and just match our position and velocity conditions at high gate. Now, the time that this point is biased back from high gate is a function of how much uncertainty we have in the thrust of the descent engine. So we have to ensure that if we have a low thrust case, that we still can match the desired velocity at high gate. Now, the guidance system has command over attitude during this whole region in here, but it's not able to implement its commanded thrust until it calls for a thrust level in the throttleable region. So in this phase, it starts off with a commanded thrust close to what it's getting. There's a slight deviation here. And then partway down the trajectory, we shift the targeting from the fictitious target to the desired high gate target. And then as the thrust command tapers off and reaches down where the descent engine could be throttled, then that part of the guidance system is implemented. And from then on, it can command both throttle and attitude. And we see what happens if we have off-nominal thrust in the next slide here. Again, a trajectory profile. In this case, we have low thrust-to-weight ratio, so we're not decelerating as fast as we would in the nominal case. The solid line again shows the normal variation of thrust, but now we have a lower than that variation. And as we make the guidance, the target switchover at this point, what happens is that the commanded thrust reaches the throttleable region later than it would in the normal case. It still reaches there prior to the time of getting to high gate, so it still has the opportunity to match velocities. In the high thrust case, it does just the opposite. The actual thrust is above the nominal thrust, and as a result, the command gets down to the throttleable region earlier than the normal case. Now, this might sound good, but this means that we're operating in the low thrust-to-weight region for a longer period of time, and this is what costs us a little bit of fuel. The cost of fuel is indicated in this slide, showing on the left scale the delta V penalty, on the right the percentage uncertainty in thrust to weight, and on the lower scale the time that is required that you bias the fictitious target back from the high gate target. We're talking about thrust uncertainties of the order of 2%, so you can see that that means we have about 60 seconds of bias time in there, and the cost is somewhere close to 50 feet per second. The consideration of going range free that we mentioned earlier could save this 50 feet per second, and that's the only real reason that we have kept it into consideration. Now, the landing radar has been discussed earlier. It comes into play during the braking phase. In fact, it's used throughout the braking phase. It comes into operation about 40,000 feet of altitude and begins to provide altitude update information at 25,000 and velocity information about 15,000. For purposes of continuity, I'll discuss the landing radar operation throughout the other two phases. It's important to know how the landing radar information should update the inertial system. This chart shows the weighting factors, both for altitude on the bottom as a function, the altitude weighting factor as a function of altitude, velocity weighting factor as a function of velocity. Now, this should start at 25,000, and it increases from zero up to about 0.55 at zero altitude. Now, there's an iteration made in altitude every 2 seconds, so that at any point, say 6,000 feet, where this might be 5/10, you'd take 5/10 of the difference between inertial altitude and radar altitude and add that to the inertial value. And then 2 seconds later, you'd do the same thing. So even though you're using 5/10 weighting, after several iterations, you've removed all the error, or almost all the error. The same thing happens in velocity, except that the iteration there is each beam only comes around either 6 or 8 seconds. For each 2 second iteration, you take up one of the three beams. There the weighting begins of the order of 1600 feet per second and linearly increases down to zero. The effect of the landing radar update, coupled with some typical type dispersions of the guidance system and uncertainties of the lunar terrain knowledge, flying over a typical terrain has been investigated. This is the terrain that was looked at, where on the bottom scale here we show the altitude of the profile to scale. And it's such that you can barely see it, but these are a couple of fairly large craters in here, about 1 mile across. We're over a total range here of 25 miles. We get up to about 2,000 feet. Because it's hard to see, we expand the altitude scale here, and you can see that at one point it gets up to about 2,500 feet. We looked at a number of approaches to typical landing sites. This wasn't the worst one, I don't believe, but it was one of the worst. Now, the effect of flying over this type of terrain is indicated on this slide, where we have time history plots, again, of the terrain itself. And what we did is take it at this point and just flip it over for a mirror image, which makes it even worse. It appears that there's a nice big mountain you're flying over there. And then also plotted the pitch angle and the thrust as a function of time, indicating where the fictitious target is, or the point where normally the thrust would be reduced, the high gate position where the pitch attitude would be changed, and the low gate position. The solid curve indicates what would happen if you were over ideal flat terrain with no errors, and it shows a little dip in pitch angle each time you meet one of these milestones, and then the big reduction when you get to high gate. And when you fly over this terrain, and in this case we had a 1,600-foot negative altitude error in the inertial system, they combine together such that prior to reaching the fictitious target, we command a pitch angle lower than normal, and then beyond that point, it goes up to where it's a deviation of almost 10 degrees. Most of the deviation is prior to the time that we hit high gate, and after that point, the two are very close together. The thrust levels are very little different for the two. Now, there is some delta Vs associated with this. For the optimum case, the normal case here, we're talking about a delta V 6281. But in flying over this terrain, the increase was only of the order of 16 feet per second. And our fuel budget, we've allowed up to 60 feet per second to take care of larger altitude uncertainties. One of the important things that the crew will have to do during the braking phase is to monitor the systems. Now, we have the primary guidance system will be controlling the limb during this period. We also have an abort guidance system that will be navigating, but will not be capable of taking over to fly the descent. It could take over if you have to abort. But it does provide navigation data, and so we can compare the two to see if the system, either system, is malfunctioning. So we have a function called guidance monitoring, the purpose of which is to provide an assessment of the trajectory, to detect failures of the guidance system, to isolate those failures, and to assure that you can do it in time to make a safe abort. There are two techniques that we are presently considering, and they're quite similar. One is where we establish prior to the flight some trajectory bounds, considering the off nominal performance of either both the primary and the abort guidance system. And then if either one of those get outside the bounds, we suspect that one of the systems is not working right. Or else we can take a difference between the two, and if that number gets larger than you would expect out of three sigma performance deviations of both, you begin to suspect a failure. The altitude and altitude rate are the parameters that are most significant for abort safety. They're the ones that can get you into trouble. And the altitude rate is the thing that is most sensitive to failure and failure detection. Fortunately, it appears that MSFN has a good capability of measuring altitude rate, and this should provide a good independent source to isolate failures. An important feature is that the three sigma type guidance deviations should not endanger the flight until after you get down to high gate. Well, I think that summarizes most of the braking phase. Just to go back a minute, the braking phase covers some 450 seconds of flight, at which time the objective is to use the descent engine for as long as we possibly can in the fixed throttle position to maintain trajectory. But we use a target switchover technique that allows us to throttle down prior to reaching the high gate position so that we can be assured of matching the desired velocity and position. Going into the next phase, which if you recall, we've termed final approach, this is a phase that's probably the most important from a standpoint of the shaping that we want to apply to the trajectory, because it's in this phase that the crew is going to have visibility and time provided so that he can assess the landing area. We also assume a requirement that we want to provide the crew an opportunity to assess the flight safety of the trajectory. To do this, we want to keep the platform that he's flying in relatively stable, so he's not doing much maneuvering around. The constraints are familiar ones: fuel, the window size, since he's got to use the window to see where he's going, the thrust to weight of the descent and ascent engines, and a desire to always maintain a trajectory such that if we have to stage, we can do it with the ascent engine. And the reason for this is that even though they both start about the same initial thrust to weight ratio, when we're approaching the landing, the thrust to weight capability of the descent engine is almost twice that of the ascent engine. The other constraints, of course, are the environmental problems, the terrain, lighting, contrast properties. There are a number of variables that we have to assess. We can combat some of these by varying such things as pitch attitude, the transition or high gate altitude, the flight path angle, and the look angle that the crew would have to the landing area as its reference to the thrust axis. Now, perhaps the first thing that has to be decided is where are we going to put high gate or the transition altitude. We've looked at the factors that appear to affect this choice. They include the range from which the landing area could be assessed, the time that the crew will need to assess the landing area, and then this flight safety requirement, with the added stipulation that we would like to be able to proceed to high gate even if the landing radar is not operating, because after that time we do perform a pitch maneuver that makes it more likely that the beam configuration would be normal to the surface and the system would work. And this has to consider the ascent engine abort boundary, the uncertainties of the terrain and so forth. The ascent engine abort boundary should be explained on the next slide, which is a slide showing as a function of altitude and descent rate what the nominal profile is, and then what the boundary would be if at any point you wanted to switch over to the ascent engine, assuming that it's going to take you 4 seconds to delay. So there's some combination of altitude and descent rate or altitude rate from which you couldn't make an abort, because you're going to descend from that point some number of feet before you attain level flight and begin to ascend. For example, at 150 feet per second, this limit is, if you're descending at 150 feet per second, you're going to continue on your trajectory for a little over 3,000 feet before you reach level flight. We have a margin of almost 100% between the nominal profile and the ascent engine. The descent engine, because of the improved thrust-to-weight capability in this region, provides almost a factor of 4 safety here. The other factors that determine this high gate altitude have to do with all the uncertainties of the terrain and the uncertainties of the guidance system. And these are summarized here, and it's somewhat a function of how you do your navigation or how you combine your navigation. Now, what we have plotted here is as a function of different means of combining navigation information, a summation of the terrain uncertainties and the guidance system uncertainties, where this group is the random uncertainty and this group is the biases. And it just says that if we do MSFN without any improvement of knowledge of the terrain of the moon as we presently know it, then our primary system on the landing approach might have an altitude uncertainty 3 sigma of approaching 4,000 feet. The terrain profile uncertainty, 3 sigma, 4,700 feet, and a big uncertainty in the lunar radius. This is equivalent to 3 kilometers, both for the lunar radius uncertainty and another kilometer or another 3 kilometers RSS with that for the uncertainty in the particular area of the landing site. The others are biases here. Again, a 1 sigma, 1 kilometer uncertainty. The terrain profile, which is the effect of allowing some slopes in the area and having to consider the the guidance dispersions, how much area over which we might land, and then the staged abort criteria. Now, I wouldn't want to say how best to add all these together, but any way you add them together, you come up with a fairly high requirement for high gate. I hesitate to believe that you'd really have to have it this high, but nevertheless, even reducing this quite a bit, we wouldn't want to have our high gate quite this high. It would cost too much fuel. Now, if we do either MSFN or onboard navigation and include sightings on the landing area, this would be done by the CSM, we're able to eliminate much of the altitude uncertainties. This is the relative uncertainty between the limb and the surface of the moon. For example, we reduce the terrain profile uncertainty by a factor of about 5 or more. The lunar radius uncertainty by a drastic factor. We almost eliminate entirely the bias for lunar radius and the terrain profile. Now, because we've eliminated a lot of this, the area that we're worried about for staged abort means that we're getting closer to the surface with less uncertainty, so we're operating in the region where the altitude rate is lower, and therefore that requirement is lower. Now, it doesn't make much difference whether we're on board or MSFN. The numbers are not much different. So it appears that if we do want to go down to high gate without landing radar, and if we do make sightings from orbit on the landing area, that our high gate minimum requirement would be of the order of 7,500 feet. Now, if we allow the pilot some 10 seconds to make this assessment, that moves the high gate altitude back to the region from 8,500 to 9,000 feet. So if we assume that we've established high gate at 9,000 feet, this is what it's cost us. This shows the delta V penalty as a function of the high gate choice, indicating that our selection of 9,000 feet cost us of the order of 220 or 25 feet per second of fuel. This is just in the applies now to the region of the final approach phase. If we selected a slightly different high gate altitude, the slope of the curve in this region is about 20 feet per second, so we could change it to plus or minus by that much and gain or lose 20 feet per second. The other things that are very important to us are attitude or the look angle that attitude is going to provide to us during the final approach region. This slide again shows as a function of the delta V cost the variation both for varying the flight path angle and varying the look angle, where the look angle is reference to the thrust axis of the vehicle. If you recall, the wind of the limb has the lower limit about 25 degrees here, so we certainly want to be able to look at the site with a look angle somewhat above that. We've chosen the value of 35 degrees because we'd like to have some margin, and then recalling that the descent engine is gimbal, so that CG offsets have to be trimmed out, and this could eat into this margin by a couple of degrees. We also want to be able to change our landing site and accept the transients, the change in attitude associated with that, and still be able to look at the landing area. Now, to go along with the choice now of 35 degrees of look angle, 9,000 foot high gate altitude, the associated pitch angle of the vehicle in this region is about 40 degrees pitch back, and it's maintaining that fairly constant. Our choice of flight path angle, you can see, is not too sensitive in this region, although this was the result of a parameter study. When we put the actual guidance in, there was a little bit more penalty than is indicated here, but it's not too sensitive. We've chosen somewhere in the region of 14 to 15 degrees. To indicate what this has done now to the shaping of the trajectory, we make a comparison going back to the old fuel optimum, plotting both vertical velocity and horizontal velocity as a function of this should be time to go down to low gate. The vertical velocity, you see, for corresponding altitude situations, we've not greatly affected the vertical velocity. We have made a big change in the time to go. The time to go change is primarily because we've made a big change in horizontal velocity. We're at 8,600 feet. We were in the fuel optimum, some 1,200 feet per second. We reduced that down to 550 or so in the design trajectory. So we've made a big difference, and this is reflected, of course, in the flight path angle. The flight path angle for the trajectory that we were on is some 14 to 15 degrees compared to 9 degrees for the fuel optimum case. Now, it doesn't do any good to be able to see unless you can do something about it. So this shows what footprint capability we would have if we were willing to spend some fuel. Now, it's a plot that from which you're looking directly down on the moon's surface, where the vehicle is at this point at some 8,000 feet and without any redesignation would be going to this point, 0, 0 on the scale. Just for reference purposes, we put in a 3,000 foot radius circle at this point. And if we were willing to spend 100 feet per second of fuel, we could go further down range by some 8,000 feet, or laterally some 10,000 feet. And correspondingly, if we spent 200 or 300 feet per second, that could be increased. And the pilot doesn't see the whole picture here. The lower window limit comes in right here. And in addition, the side limitation of his window is this line, so he can only see the area to the left. The pilot on the other side has the same limitation, but where the image has been flipped over. We put on here indications of azimuth deviations, and partly because everyone is concerned about visibility, and they won't like to consider how much it would cost to put in a dog leg. So if you, at this altitude, wanted to dog leg by 20 degrees, you could go 10,000 feet over, and it would cost you 100 feet per second of fuel. We'll talk about the effect of the dog leg a little bit more. Now, that's just from 8,000 feet. The footprint doesn't stay constant, as you can see in this slide, where it's the same type of plot, but the LEM vehicle is proceeding from its position at 8,000 feet to 5,000 feet to 3,000 feet. And if we talk about only a single delta V capability here, 100 feet per second, the contours progressively decrease in size. Now, a fortunate circumstance is that even though the contours are decreasing in size, they subtend almost the same angle to the pilot, so that he has a pretty good idea of his footprint capability just by knowing how much angle change he might want to make. We've tried to develop a logic as to how much fuel we should provide for changing the landing site. And it's a pretty hard logic to develop. We start with the basic assumption that we're going into an area that should be generally good. And we should not have to make a large redesignation just for terrain purposes. And there may be a real good way to go about it in selecting the numbers. We haven't found it yet, and we've come up with a value of saying that at 5,000 feet of altitude, we'd like to be able to change the landing site by 3,000 feet downrange. So that means that our footprint capability associated with this much fuel, which turns out to be 45 feet per second, has the contours as indicated here. Now, an additional limitation that we've imposed is to say that we don't want to redesignate to a point that would cause transient in attitude that would make us lose sight of the target. So that's the reason that these lower limits are imposed here. As you know, if you want to go further down range and indicate this to the guidance system, the resulting response of the spacecraft is such to pitch closer to the vertical so that you have a better view of where you're going. If you do the opposite and designate short, then it pitches back and would tend to cause you to lose visibility of the target. This is how it might appear to the pilot. If you can forgive taking the winder and putting it on a flat surface when it really curves around to 80 degrees. Remember, we're pitched back about 40 degrees, so the horizon is close to 40 degrees depressed. Our landing point is about 55 degrees, again giving us 10 degrees above the lower limit of the window. You can see that we see part of the front landing pad in the window. Now, unfortunately, the pilot won't have these contours painted on the surface. If he did, in this case, if we put the 100 foot per second contour on, it would appear as such. Now, somehow this 3,000 foot reference circle got increased in size. It really looks like a much flatter ellipse than it appears here. Well, if he sees the area and has some footprint capability, we need to know how he's going to redesignate his landings. The guidance system has this capability of telling him where it's going to take him. And this slide gives a general rundown of this, where the guidance system always thinks it's in the right position. And it thinks it's in the right position with respect to the desired landing site and computes the line of sight to that position. But it's very often slightly different. The actual position might be over here, in which case that line of sight would be pointing him to a landing area that's different from the desired site. If he can identify this desired site and identify the angle between the look angle to where the guidance presently is pointing him to that, then he can introduce that into the guidance system, and it then would begin to guide in a relative frame, taking him to this position. Going back to an earlier slide now, again, this landing point designated grid is indicated here. The guidance system is displaying a coordinate out of the disk key that the pilot uses to line his sight up with so that he can see where the guidance system is taking him. The details of this grid are indicated over here. Now, this grid is actually put on both sides of the limb window so that, in effect, it provides a fixed type of gun sight, so that if the guidance system told him that the sight was beyond number 40 there, he'd have to get his eye in a position so that the two marks for number 40 lined up so that he could use that line of sight. Well, it's obvious that this system is not real sophisticated, and it's subject to some errors. Some of these errors are summarized on the next slide. Well, there could be errors due to terrain, because the landing radar could well be updating you, and the terrain that you're flying over might not be the same terrain of the landing site that you're going to. The same effect is true if the guidance system has an altitude dispersion that's not updated. Obviously, there's a bore sight installation type error of the LPD. Since it has to be referenced to the guidance system, if the attitude reference of the IMU is off, that introduces an error. And then the way that the crew would use the system or apply the system to generate an error. Some of these are pictured in our next slide. The error of application is purely a problem of geometry, for a given flight path angle anyway. Well, what we have plotted here is the downrange error as a function of either slant range to go or altitude. Again, it has to apply to a certain trajectory. Well, for example, if you have a 1 degree error in application and you're 15,000 feet away, your downrange error might be in excess of 1,000 feet. Now, we put a couple of lines in here indicating that if you really wanted to get to the site within 100 feet accuracy, and you had a half a degree error here, you'd have to get to a range of about 3,000 feet at the time of your last designation, or about half of that if your error as much as 1 degree. Well, some initial studies have indicated that on a fairly high probability basis, this error should be of the order of a half a degree. So we're not in too bad a shape. The cross-range error, simply because of the geometry and the low perspective angle that we're looking, will only be about 1/4 that of the downrange error. The picture on the right indicates the effect of altitude uncertainties, where if we're over some terrain, and that is there is a difference in that altitude between that of the intended landing site. The guidance system thinks that you want to land at terrain that's the same as that you're flying over if the landing radar has updated it such. So the line of sight would go through that point. When the pilot used it, he would just see right beyond that point to this point, and that would be a downrange error that has been introduced. So the factor for a 15-degree flight path angle is, again, about a factor of 4. So if we have 200-foot altitude difference there, we introduce about 800 feet downrange error. We mentioned earlier that we'd like to ensure that we continue to see the site when we make redesignations, and this is a typical variation of the line of sight or look angle. It's almost reflective of the changes that occur in pitch angle also as a function of time, where the look angle limitation of the lower window limit, 25 degrees, is indicated here. For the normal case, where we make no redesignations, the look angle is going to stay in the region of about 35 degrees. If at 5,000 feet we redesignate 3,000 foot long, that's a transient, and then the look angle improves into the region of about 45 degrees and stays a little above 40 degrees through most of the rest of the designation of the flight. If we go 3,000 foot short, the transient pitches the spacecraft back, and the landing site, the desired landing site, goes below the lower limit of the window, and you wouldn't be able to see where you're going until later on. So we say that for this case that we would impose a limitation that says don't redesignate more than, say, 2,000 feet short at 5,000 feet of altitude unless you're willing to give up visibility of the landing site. Well, I think that covers most of the final approach phase. Perhaps to summarize, in the final approach phase, we have provided visibility to the pilot by targeting to conditions that would cause him to use a combination of attitude and thrust level that would maintain a look angle of some 35 degrees during this phase and cover a time of a little less than 2 minutes to give him adequate time to assess the site. And we've given him the capability to redesignate by some 3,000 feet if he applies that at a certain point in the trajectory. The next phase coming up is that of the landing phase. And we emphasize how we've provided the pilot visibility during the final approach phase. But from this slide, you can see being pitched back 40 degrees and having to look out the lower part of the window is not the best type of attitude to approach a landing site. So we desire to put some more shaping into the trajectory so that right before he has to land, he's at a little bit better attitude, maybe of the order of 10 degrees, so that he's closer to a vertical type attitude that he might be used to flying a VTOL aircraft in, so that he can really get the situation under control and provide the right control of the landing. The objectives of a landing phase are summarized here. to make the final detailed assessment and selection of the landing point. And in order to give him some flexibility, we want to make sure that he can do a little bit of maneuvering here, has some footprint capability for landing point adjustment. The constraints are familiar ones. The only new one, I believe, is the possibility of the dust and constraints on visibility. And the fact that now he, if there's any rough terrain down there, he's got to come mighty close to it. There's still the limitation of attitude. You don't like to go to extreme attitudes when you're close to the surface. And we still want to be able to make a staged abort at all times if possible. Well, the result after a number of years of simulations is the trajectory that's indicated here, where the low gate position would be some 500 feet in altitude, some 1,200 feet downrange from where you'd like to land. And what happens, we're coming here with an attitude pitch back of the order of 11 degrees, with a velocity 50 feet per second forward and about 15 feet per second down. And these velocities are gradually bled off as we approach a position 100 feet of altitude above the point that we'd like to land on. Now, the views that are indicated here are again representative of what the pilot might see, where because we're close to the surface and pitch back only 11 degrees, the horizon fairly closely agrees with the horizon in his window. And we've put in a 100-foot radius circle here just to show you how it might grow as he approaches it. You can see that as he gets down to a 200-foot position, which would be right in here, that this circle is beginning to grow in size and approaching the lower limit of his window, so that when he's right over at 100 feet, he can't see the point directly beneath him, of course, but he can see the edge of that 100-foot circle if we had a 100-foot circle there. When he descends and lands on the surface, of course, the perspective to the radius of that circle increases so that he can well see it. The point is that he, even though he can't see the exact spot underneath his descent engine, he can see some of the terrain relative to that spot and get an idea of what's directly beneath him. Now, one of the points that I like to emphasize is that even though we have the capability of doing all of the phases automatically, it's in this phase that it's most likely that the pilot is going to want to take over and control manually. And this vehicle has good handling qualities. They've been checked out both on fixed-base simulation and by partial free flight and free flight simulations. And there appears to be no reason why he could not take over and fly the vehicle as well as a VTOL-type aircraft. Now, if there's any reason that he wants to deviate from this point down here, he has the capability of taking over manual control and flying to any point that's reasonable from the standpoint of how much fuel he has to spend. Now, in the final portion of the trajectory, we plan to give him additional flexibility. For example, he might desire not to proceed on this trajectory quite as expeditiously as we've pictured here. He might want to hesitate for a while and inspect the landing site. So for things, contingencies such as this, we've provided allotments in the fuel budget. The fuel budget includes some 15 seconds of equivalent hover time just to inspect the area. In addition, if the landing radar is not operating to his satisfaction, he could spend an additional 15 seconds in here and visually null the velocities before descending to the trajectory, to the surface. These contingency fuel allotments will be discussed in a little bit more detail on the next slide. Now, in addition, if when he approaches the landing point, he's not satisfied with the visibility problem. He can deviate, put in a dogleg to improve the visibility and select a landing site that he can see. Now, we've not planned a dogleg at the present time. The system is flexible enough to put in a dogleg if it's identified as a requirement. Another feature that I meant to discuss earlier has to do with the staged abort boundary. This shows a profile of altitude and altitude rate and indicates a boundary here describing conditions of combination of the two under which if he staged and had 2 seconds delay in there that even though he staged, the ascent engine would hit the surface. So we try to design the profile of descent rate such that we stay away from this boundary until we have to commit. It's obvious before you get down to the surface that you've got to violate that boundary. So we keep the profile above that until we get close to the 100-foot altitude point and then null the lateral velocities, set up about 5 feet per second of vertical velocity, and as we get down to 50 feet per second, put that at the desired contact velocity and proceed on down. So the amount of time that we spend in violation of this boundary might be limited to the order of 20 seconds or less. We've said an awful lot about fuel budgets, and I'd like to summarize the fuel budget. The upper portion here gives the baseline trajectory allowance, including the transfer, the Hohmann transfer, the braking, final approach, and landing phases. Now, these all add together to 6554. If I remember right, that's some 500 feet per second more than the one with the thrust-to-weight ratio of 3/10 of the fuel optimum type trajectory. But the important thing to consider here are all the contingencies that we've allowed for. We may not be at 80 nautical miles for the CSM, so we've allotted enough fuel to take care of as much as 10 nautical miles deviation or 13 feet per second. And the braking phase, this again costs us 15 feet per second. And if we have the expected thrust dispersions, this is a random number here. The reason we put it in a different column, we divided up both into mean type contingencies and those that could be described as random, or they could both save fuel as well as cost fuel. And during the braking phase, if our altitude dispersions have not been totally eliminated by onboard sightings, this may cost us 60 feet per second of fuel. The final approach phase, the 45 feet per second for landing site redesignations, plus 15 feet per second random for refinements in the redesignation. And in the landing, where we see the most of the contingencies, manual control variations, 80 feet per second with 100 foot per second random. The landing radar uncertainties, because we may have to hover and null the velocities, or because the landing radar may indicate that we're going down faster than we actually are, and therefore more time would be spent in the descent. That would eat up fuel. To inspect the landing site, 15 seconds of hover, and what we call a fuel depletion margin, 40 feet per second. So the total is 7,050. If we added all the means and also the RSS, these random numbers together. Now, the one on the right here shows kind of a time history or how goes it type of plot of fuel in terms of velocity, feet per second, or in terms of pounds as a function of time during the trajectory, where the important milestones are indicated down here, the descent to Hohmann transfer, and we break it because of the time there, from power descent, braking phase to high gate to low gate, touchdown. You see, most of the fuel is expended during the braking phase. If we proceeded without the use of any contingency fuel all the way down to landing, the present fuel capacity of some 7,332 feet per second would leave us 778 feet per second of fuel remaining. This down to this point takes about 10 minutes, 600 seconds. If we burned all that fuel in hover conditions, you could see we could stay up some 2.5 minutes more. The dashed lines is a case where we are using all of the mean contingencies here and adding them up so that when we get down to the final position here, we go up to this insert and see that using all the mean contingencies leave us some 425 feet per second. And if we use all those random contingencies, RSS together, we still have some 282 feet per second. Well, that's equivalent to 75 to 80 seconds of hover time. Now, that's true if, sure enough, we do have 7,332 feet per second that we can utilize. Well, we've discussed the getting all the way down to the surface. I'd like to discuss a little bit the actual touchdown control. Well, we have a nice picture of this about to happen, showing, I don't know whether you can see them, but there are little probes going down beneath the landing pads. But the touchdown control can be done either automatically, the system has a capability, except the pilot has to cut the engine off, or it can be done manually. By manual here, we would mean that we do provide automatic control loops in there to make the pilot's task easier. And using this, he can either go visual, he doesn't run into the dust, or there is the capability of going instruments. If his visibility is impaired, he has adequate instrumentation so that he can proceed right on down to the surface. These are a list of some of the major sources of system errors here. The predominant one turns out to be the landing radar velocity measurement, but also contributing are the IMU misalignments, the display system, and for the manual case, the pilot puts in a little error too, if they'll forgive me, and the CG position could well be off a little bit. The descent engine has a trim position, trim capability so that it biases the bank angle and causes a slight deviation in the attitude at which the descent engine is pointed straight down. The constraints that we have to live with include the landing gear design limits. This is the landing gear of the limb, the velocity conditions there. The fact that the descent engine, or the constraint that we desire, is the descent engine be off at touchdown. This is to avoid the possible ingestion of the shockwave and causing something undesirable to happen to the descent engine. The sequence of events is indicated here, where we have provided the probes to give a discrete indication of altitude. The length of these probes have been designed such that we combine the response times of the system together with the response times of the crew in such a way as to get the engine off at touchdown. The sequence goes as indicated here, where at probe contact, actuates a light in the cockpit, and the pilot activates the descent engine cutoff, and his response time has been very well pinned down to of the order of 2/10 to 7/10 of a second. The descent engine control assembly has a response time of about 1/10 of a second. The engine fuel valves themselves take about 0.15 seconds to activate. And then the engine tail off it goes down about 3 time constants at 0.12 seconds. So that then the engine would be off at touchdown. The next slide shows the problem of vertical velocity control at touchdown, in which we've plotted the descent rate at touchdown as a function of the descent rate at probe contact, both of these in feet per second, and indicated the constraint of the engine being on by this line of 45 degrees. So anything that gets down into this region, we violated the constraint. So with the particular design probe length, 53 inches, coupled with the engine delay times of 25 hundredths of a second, plus the tail-off time, you see the effect that pilot reaction time would have on the actual touchdown velocity, where if we have a desired final descent rate of 3.5 feet per second, and we hit that, and we have 6/10 of a second reaction time, we would get the engine off before touchdown, and we'd land at slightly over 5 feet per second. And you can see that if you don't hit this descent rate, you're increased because of possibly erroneous information from the landing radar, or that your reaction time increases, you stand the danger of having the engine on at touchdown. But we've looked at the combination of all these factors, and that's what's determined the design length of the probe. And we're at a region here such that on a very high probability basis, we will stay within the desired region of descent velocities and get the engine off prior to touchdown. I'll go into that in a little bit more detail. I identified the landing radar as one of the big contributors to the error, and I don't want to overemphasize it because it, even though it's one of the bigger ones, I don't want to say that it's contributing too much. It's within the budget, but this gives a an indication of the both the specification performance in terms of velocity for the three axes, 1.5 feet per second, and we presently are predicting that it will beat that by a factor of 3/4 of a foot per second vertically, and at least meet the lateral velocity and forward velocity case. For purposes of the analysis, we've also assumed the degraded values here by doubling these numbers. Now, in going through a whole series of simulations in which we provide the pilot with a faithful simulation of his displays and allow him to get in the loop with all the control modes that he has available, we've plotted contours showing the probability that he would stay within the landing gear design envelope. The landing gear design envelope is indicated by the dashed line. This is a plot of vertical velocity, feet per second, and horizontal velocity, feet per second. The design envelope starts at 10 feet per second with zero horizontal velocity, going to 7 feet per second when in combination with 4 feet per second horizontal. The three curves are probability contours and apply to the case where we have the specification performance of the landing radar. So you can see that the 3-9 probability contour still stays well within the design envelope. The next one shows what happens if we vary the performance of the landing radar. And it includes both the case where we have no errors at all, the spec performance, which we got from the previous chart. These are all the 9-9 contours. The predicted curve, predicted landing radar performance and the associated curve, and then the contour in the event that the landing radar performance is degraded. And it's only in this case that the 9-9 contour approaches the landing gear design envelope. Even in this case, there would be better than a 3 sigma type of probability that we would be within the design envelope. It's also of interest to compare the automatic type control with manual control. In this case, the curves that are dashed apply to automatic control. The solid lines are manual control, both for the case of the degraded radar and predicted radar. You can see that if we have the predicted radar, that the automatic is somewhat better than the manual, but both well within the design envelope. In the degraded radar case, there's less difference between the two. So it appears that when the radar degrades, that it is the predominant contributor to errors in landing velocity. Now, of course, this type of curve does not give you any appreciation for the advantage of the pilot being in the loop and actually selecting the final point of touchdown right prior to the touchdown. Well, that gets us all the way down to the surface. There is one other thing that I would like to discuss, and that is in the unlikely event that we didn't hit exactly as we would like, are we able to then make an abort? And this slide perhaps has too much information on it, but I'd like to follow through here just a minute. It's a plot of attitude and degrees against attitude rate. And the main thing on it are a couple of boundaries, such that if we wind up on the right of the boundary, we can't make an abort, or probably can't make an abort. But any time we're to the left, we probably can make a successful abort. The reason that we've got two boundaries is that there are different modes of control available to the pilot. If he takes over attitude control and pushes his attitude controller against the stops, he gets the full attitude acceleration capability of the vehicle and has no attitude rate limitation. If, instead of that, he just punches the abort button, if he happens to be tilting in roll, there is an automatic limitation here of 5 degrees per second. So there's a little bit of a difference in the two boundaries. Now, what we've plotted here is a case as it applies to a limb that is touched down and then is tilting over, pivoting about one pad. Now, some of the curves here apply for kind of a rigid body case that has no energy absorption. We have two curves here. The solid line indicates what would happen if we landed with 7 feet per second vertical and 4 feet per second horizontal, and in some way, after touchdown, converted all of that energy into rotational energy. We'd start off with about a little less than 30 degrees per second of rate, and then go up to a point that's about the balance point here, and then continue the tip over. The other solid line is the combination of conditions on which we would just get up and balance on that one pad. The timelines here indicate, at least for that simple case, how long it takes to get to these combinations of conditions. Now, the indication is that we could get up to an attitude of about 50 degrees at 10 degrees per second and still be able to initiate a staged abort. This allows some 1.4 seconds for the pilot reaction time and all the staging time and thrust buildup delays. Now, there's an example case on here that was derived from considering all the dynamics of the landing gear, the energy-absorbing capabilities of the gear. It was one where that was a very extreme case where we landed, calculated the landing at 7 feet per second vertical, 4 horizontal, and in some way put 2 of the gear on a ledge and let the other 2 fall into a 6-foot hole. Now, that's this dashed line here, indicating at first contact of the first 2 pads, we created a rate close to that 30 degrees, and then kept that up until the other 2 pads contacted, at which time we began to take energy out of the system and proceeded on over here. Now, we don't have agreement between this neutral stability line and this curve, because remember, this was neutral stability was only for a rigid body case and didn't include the dynamics of the structure or the landing gear. And in this case, the vehicle did continue to topple, but it agreed the time that it reached this position was almost 4 seconds. So our conclusion was that the pilot appears to have a good length of time here in which to recognize that he's going beyond a position where it's possible for him to be balanced and then fall back, so that he could initiate a staged abort if this ever became a requirement. I'd like to go back, just in summary, to the profile of the trajectories, and just again to point out some of the features. Somehow we got the wrong ones here. Can you continue on for about 3 or 4 slides till we get to the profile of the trajectories? Well, maybe in view of not having those slides, I could just summarize it. We've tried to recognize all of the problems in making the lunar landing approach, recognize the desire for having the pilot in the loop to assess the area and to provide the assessment that of the area that is suitable for landing. We've paid some amount of fuel for doing this. The amount that we paid presently is well within the fuel budget, and there currently exists a pad in the fuel budget to allow for contingencies that we've not presently identified.
That's it. Thank you, Don. All that trajectory shaping for the use of the pilot, I'm not really convinced that Surveyor got down safely. I'd make one point that I just noticed when you those charts of the actual touchdown velocities on automatic and on manual were both for the condition where the pilot was not looking at the surface. I believe he was essentially intruded into the loop to work off the gauges. Isn't that right, Don?
That's correct. I fail to make that point. If he's able to go down visually, we predict that he can fly this vehicle as well as a VTOL or a helicopter, and he could get the velocities, the lateral velocities, probably down better than 1 foot per second. So all the cases that we showed were for the design case where he would be using his instruments and would not have any access to visual information out of the window.
Any questions? Discussion? I'd like to hold it relatively short because we're running a little bit late. We'll have more time for discussion tomorrow. Tommy?
Yeah, why on your touchdown velocity curve, the problem
Tell me, what we plotted there is the resolved horizontal velocity. As you're aware, the regular landing gear design envelope accounts both for uphill and downhill type of landings. The plot that I showed was irrespective of the direction of the velocity. So they would almost provide a toroidal type of shape if you put it in three dimensions.
Yeah, I think the answer is it's not very probable you're going to touch down with zero velocity, nor are you going to touch down with more than 4 feet per second, and he's working with an absolute value of the velocity rather than... Okay. Anything else? All right. We're ready to adjourn then. The agenda for tomorrow is published. I would suggest that we change the uniform of the day. I realize most of you, when you found out it was going to be a weekend session, were fit to be tied, but I'd suggest that we wear sports shirts tomorrow if you have them with you. The arrangements to go to the Catholic Church need not be restricted to Catholics. There's a recruiting drive going on, and we'll see you tomorrow at 9 o'clock.